thank you so much for tuning in to As the Worm Turns. This is DJ Peggy Soup filling in for the lovely Jill Spears. Lance is our guest this evening, and we're going to be talking about grains. It is a call-in show, so please do 527-4868 and 866-KVNF now. If you're wondering where you're dialed in at KVNF, that's 90.9 in Paonia and 89.1 KVMT out of Montrose. Wow. Again, I adore the moments we have before the show. I get so many beautiful little tidbits. And actually, we do have a couple of things. Last week, if you were lucky enough and to tune in for our pruning show on fruit trees and ornamentals, we have a couple of little reminders.
Yeah, I just had a couple little things going on there. And one was I didn't mention to not prune when it's really cold. And most people aren't going to be out there. But mm-hmm. the reason why is those branches can be frozen. And if they're frozen, you don't cut the branch. It gets crushed.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, it doesn't heal back as well.
Right. So that was, now, what would you call really cold?
Probably 15.
15? That's really cold.
18 degrees.
I'm like, I wasn't enjoying it at like 38. I was not thrilled about it.
Yeah. Well, I don't even start feeling the cold till it gets down to around 12, 15 degrees.
Well seasoned. That's what yeah. I'm talking about.
And the other one is just a little thing that when you're pruning it and you got all that brush trimmings on the ground, it's really tedious to pick all that stuff up. So don't wait till you've done all your trees. Do it as you go along. It makes it a lot easier.
Right. As I said, pick up as you go. It's how I cook. Yeah. Clean as you go. Just get it out of the way.
Get it out of the way. And there is one other little thing I wrote down here is because I do prune for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this on a regular basis. People plant their fruit trees right next to a fence, to a building. And you cannot get to them. They're on sides of hills. Those are really interesting on a picking ladder to be up.
Right. Yes, I inherited several trees that are directly on a fence.
On a fence.
They're on a fence and going into the neighbor's driveway.
Yeah.
Which I did notice while I was doing some cleanup early this week that I was like, oh, it's okay. Do some pruning. You know, just get it off your truck, whatever.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, so it's best to give them some room, 10, 12 feet. With the new trees, most people don't plant standards anymore, which are, mm-hmm. can get up to 30, 40 feet tall, especially the apples and pears.
Right.
But most people are planting semi-dwarfs or a little bit smaller.
Yes.
So give them 10 to 12 feet away from the building or a wall. Of course, we had Jared call up last week.
Jared, for apple.
And he was doing a cordon. Mm-hmm. Those are usually put up against a wall. And espalier is another name for a different type of pruning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something totally different. And it's actually designed, that type of pruning and growing is designed to be on a wall or a fence.
Okay. Which I'm very intrigued by that. And if I had more property, I'd probably mess around with it. So we are talking about grains. Again, this is As the Worm Turns. Lance is here. So awesome to talk to him, and a call-in show, so please feel free when you think of it, just call on in 527-4868 866-KVNF now. So I start out, my first question was, how well do grains grow here? We're at a very high elevation. Mm-hmm. And coming originally from Michigan, Grains are huge, especially on the eastern side of the state. But again, very low elevation.
Very low elevation. Yeah, grains grow really good here. You know, and corn's the ones you see a lot, mainly mm-hmm. more down on Delta. You see some in the Norfolk Valley, but they're starting to push their limits at 5,000 to 6,000 feet. And I'm at 6,000 feet, and I'm getting good crops of corn.
Excellent.
And that might change if the weather change keeps on taking place.
Right.
You know, that will change. But what I'd like to talk about is just the different grains. There you have winter grains, which mm-hmm. are the winter wheats, hard winter wheats. Those are usually bread for bread. And then there's rye, spelt. There's different types of winter barley. And there's icorn, which is an Eastern European grain. Very early, is one of the first wheat types that were grown in Eastern or domesticated in Eastern Europe. And the raw icorn and the spelt both have a husk. So they're very, very difficult to thresh and get cleaned out. Right now, the last I might have mentioned in the past, I had that spelt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting it a handful at a time on the floor in my garden room, and I'm twisting my feet on top of it to get the grains out. That's what I'm doing.
Okay, because very difficult to get the husks off.
Yeah, and I've threshed it, and I've screened it, and I got all the grains that came out from there out, which I got about 2 gallons of that. But then I had like 14 gallons of this with the husk.
So I'm imagining quite the little twist and shout dance party room.
It's like a slow slow doing the twist on the 60. That's what it's like. And so anyways, and then you have the spring grains. And again, there's hard spring grains. And then the soft wheats, which are mainly your durum wheats, your pasta wheats, spaghetti, those kind of wheats are low gluten, and they're planted in the springtime. Go back to this one. Winter grains are usually planted in September through October.
And they winter over.
They'll come up. You want them about anywhere 2 to 3 inches high. Any higher than that, if it gets really cold, they can be winter burned, except for rye. Extremely hardy.
All right, so for the winter grains, because this is so amazing that there's so many time frames for grains that very new to me. So winter grains, you plant in the fall, September through October, and you let them come up 2 to 3 inches high. Do you then cover them?
No.
No.
You just let and this has been a great year because of the snow cover.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So what happens if it gets really, really cold? And
If you don't have any snow cover and it gets really cold, they're going to get burnt. It might not kill them, but it'll, and it might.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know. Welcome to farming.
Yeah, exactly.
That could happen.
Yeah. The only one that won't get killed is the rye.
Okay.
Extremely hardy. Okay. And then the spring grains are planted in April, early May. And I mentioned the hard and soft wheats. There's also lots of your barley, oats, kamut, and quinoa. Even though it's not a true grain, we call it a grain. It will be quinoa. If you know where there's a patch of lamb's quarter, when the lamb's quarter germinates, that's when you plant quinoa. They're about the same type of plant.
So now, is there a winter barley and a spring barley?
Yeah.
Two different kinds of barley.
Two different types of barley. And I have Tibetan barley that was grown at 12,000 feet or so in Tibet.
And is that a spring?
And that's a spring. And it's one of the problems with it is that being at 12,000 feet, it's not used to heat. So
now we have the little pendulum there where usually we're worried about is it gonna make it at 6,000 feet, and now you're like, oh, the Tibetan barley
doesn't like the heat.
Okay.
Yeah. So and also Tibetan barley has a tendency to lodge, which is to fall over. It doesn't have a strong stalk. But I heard from some other friends traveling in Tibet that the Tibetan people actually have a song, may the barley fall over because it's so heavy with grain.
Oh.
So.
Very nice. I like that song.
Yeah. And then you have the summer grains. And, you know, those are pretty traditional corn, millet, sorghum. Most people don't grow sorghum, but there is a grain sorghum that's really quite good. And in Africa, it's mainly used for making beer.
Okay.
Make beer out of that sorghum. But a sorghum can be take the place of corn as far as feed for your chickens.
Okay.
And it doesn't want to be watered that much, and it does not want to be fertilized that much. So it makes it much easier if you don't have that large amounts of water or fertilizers like corn needs.
Mm-hmm.
The sorghum only gets about 2.5 to 3 feet tall.
Okay. And I really picked his brain because I'm like, what is sorghum? What is it?
Well, in the books, it's there's many different types. Broom mm-hmm. corn is a type of sorghum. Only okay. you don't grow, you don't take, you don't eat the seeds off of that.
Right.
And then there's sorghum cane syrup that mm-hmm. they crush and boil down, similar to maple syrup, only it's a different flavor. Mm-hmm. And that's used strictly for that. And then there's grain sorghum. And it's also, I think it's called greater millet. I'll look in my other book. I have another book. That's a book on the origin of food crops.
Okay.
And it does have sorghum in there. And it does. That's where they're showing mm-hmm. in Africa. They're making beer out of it. And how would you like a beer that looks white?
Because that's that would be so much fun. I would like that. I would like that. I'm excited about that. One has me the most intrigued about growing sorghum is what?
Yeah, and then there's teff, which I've seen grown here mm-hmm. On Redlands Mesa, and then I also grow amaranth about every few years, 2 or 3 years, and it does really good. Extremely drought tolerant. And poor soil. So if you just got a spot out in the back and you mm-hmm. got a little, you know, just throw some amaranth seed in there, and you can get, you'd have to play with varieties. I have one called Mana mm-hmm. de Oro. So it's a gold seed mm-hmm. and it does really well. And if you plant it near other plants, mm-hmm. it has an extreme root system and it will stunt anything within 2 feet on either side.
There you have it. Amaranth. Matter. A gorgeous, yeah. But gorgeous.
And
brilliantly
mine,
gorgeous.
Yeah, mine usually get 6 to 7 feet tall.
Okay.
And how I tell when I'm going to harvest the amaranth, because it's indeterminate, it just keeps on growing. Mm-hmm. Either you have to stop watering it or you pull it, or frost coming.
Yeah. All right.
And that will take care of it. But I usually watch when the birds really start going after it. Mm-hmm. And this last year, we had a windstorm. And I could see that the wind was going to blow them over.
Okay.
So I cut them right off. I went out there with my wheelbarrow and just cut them off, the seed heads, and laid them out in sheets and dried them inside.
Oh, nice.
Is what
nice.
I did with amaranth last year.
Now, let's say, because we did talk about seed saving. Now, is amaranth a crop because they are so gorgeous and they do get so tall and they're very mm-hmm. abundant, will they reseed themselves?
I have volunteers from time to time.
Okay.
But it's okay. Mm-hmm. It's not a problem. You know, what it will cross with, thinking of seed saving,
uh-huh.
that pigweed that we have out in the wild,
yeah.
that's amaranth. And that black seed that you see when you buy amaranth in the store, you see sometimes there'll be a black seed in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the pigweed seed. It's got in there.
Awesome.
Okay. So that's amaranth. If you really need something to eat and you see a stand of that stuff, go for it.
All right. And you would grind it?
You can grind it. You can actually cook it just like rice.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. For those who don't know how to process amaranth, you can boil it like rice
mm-hmm.
and or grind it for a flour.
Grind it with flour. And I just mix it with the other grains. I mainly put it in my bread.
Okay.
And just mix it right in there. And it works just fine.
So fun.
Yeah.
So fun.
So another thing we mentioned earlier. Oh, actually, let's look at this book here. I have this book. It's called Small Scale Grain Raising by Gene Lodson. And I think there's a new revised edition. This is the old original one. And anyways, he gives some amounts that a family of four
mm-hmm.
possibly will need. So wheat is at one bushel. Corn is a half a bushel. Popcorn, half a bushel. Grain sorghum, half a bushel. Oats, about a quarter of a bushel. Barley, and these are just, you know, it depends on if you're making lots of bread or not, or, you know, how you're sprouting or what you're doing with this.
All right, so a bushel.
A bushel.
Let's go, because I know what a bushel basket looks like.
Uh-huh.
And that's a big
mm-hmm. a bushel. A and just for people out there,
and is that ground? Is that ground
no,
flour?
No, that's whole grain.
Whole grain.
Whole grain.
Bushel. So okay.
A bushel is volume. It is not weight.
Right.
Like when you get that bushel box of apples,
mm-hmm.
it needs to be technically about 38 to 40 pounds.
Right.
But it doesn't have to be perfect.
Right.
Because it's volume. Whereas a bushel of corn might weigh 40 or 50 pounds.
Okay.
You know, it all depends. It's volume. It's not how the bushel is so much volume, and whatever you put in it, then you weigh it.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So that's some simple numbers there. And then the next chart actually has.
So a bushel is actually equal to approximately 9.3 gallons.
Okay.
I just popped
it on.
According to Google, okay, a bushel is about 9.3 gallons. Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the 21st century. Thank you, Google.
Okay, so the next chart actually gives amount of square footage. Mm-hmm. So field corn, 10 feet by 50, that's 500 square feet. Popcorn, depending on the variety, 10 feet by 80.
Okay, for what is that?
Popcorn.
Popcorn.
Yes, I grow popcorn too, and that's really good stuff. And oats, 10 by 62, 620. Barley, 10 by 87. Rye, 10 by 145. And buckwheat, 10 by 130. The grain sorghum, 10 by 60. And wheat, 10 feet by 109. So that's 1,090.
So wheat is the largest.
Yeah, wheat is we use it for so many different things.
Right, right.
But anyway, so, and I do all this stuff. When I grow, I actually harvest the grains with a sickle.
Look at you. Yeah, way to go, buddy.
Yeah, I don't. No machines. It's a sickle. And I have three of the standard rounded ones. Mm-hmm. And then I have a Japanese one that's more straight. Mm-hmm. And that Japanese one works really good. And the trick is, after cutting my thumb and putting a hole in my shin, the thing is you don't swing them. You get a bunch in your hand, and you take the blade and get it right next to it and just make a chopping motion right there.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't swing up above your head down into things. That's not going to work.
Yeah, mistakes are made, and so much is learned in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. This is great. So let's say you and these dimensions are for the quantity that you would want to grow for a family of four.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you have a smaller family, you might be able to bring that in a little for your smaller backyard gardeners.
Backyard. And it'd be just fun to just try.
Sure.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, if like I don't grow buckwheat, you know, so I wouldn't even, I'd have more room for something else.
Right.
And stuff. And then really good wheat growers could probably double their rate of harvest. Mm-hmm. The people that really know how to do it.
Right.
So they could cut their space in half.
Oh, there you have it.
You see.
I guess that with the fluency, once you give it a go, I just always recommend just experiment with it. Have fun with it.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the worst case scenario? You get 3 ears of corn. Awesome.
Yeah.
You know, corn, you did mention earlier, corn does take a lot of water.
Corn takes a lot of water.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of soil prep, a lot of nitrogen. Now, if you grow the old native Indian types of corn that were dryland farmed, like the Hopi's corn, stuff like that.
Right.
They, you know, they're better without fertilizer.
Okay.
Yeah, they actually do better without it than too much. Too much, and that's not what they were. Most of those corns were planted after the spring floods. And the Hopi are now down in the southwest. They dug down about 18 inches, planted that corn and seed in the moisture down low, and never touched it. That was it.
That's my kind of farming right there.
You know, or boom. The upper Missouri. Again, they planted it in the floodplains after the waters receded. And that was the fertilizer. Was just the annual flooding.
So much nutrients after that floodplain. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, are grains wind?
Grains, I don't know exactly how that works, but so corn, like how they corn is wind pollinated.
Okay. Pollinated is the word I could not grasp out of the wind there.
Yeah.
So corn's wind pollinated, and that's why you have to have it in a square.
Yeah.
So that they like block. Do it in a
yeah.
block.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas the other grains, I think they're somewhat self-fruitful. And
okay.
they pollinate themselves, and they don't cross readily. I mean, mm-hmm. they tried for years to cross rye and wheat, and it wasn't until, what, the 1900s in Mexico, 1950s in Mexico, some scientists in Mexico figured out how to, and that's where triticale comes from.
Okay.
That's actually a cross between wheat and rye.
And oh, that, interesting.
And that would be another winter grain. I never grow it, but... It's lots of people like it for animal feeds, chicken and pigs and stuff.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I know that I might play around with a couple of these spring mm-hmm. grains.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the amaranth or the sorghum really intrigues me just because I had no idea. You see it and you're like, sorghum syrup, yeah. what's
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
Is that grain like a, would that be like a rice?
Sorghum?
Yeah. What kind of...
No.
Grain does it look like?
It would look like, oh gosh. Well, if you've ever seen broom corn, it's technically the same plant.
Okay.
You know, but you're harvesting the stalks, and it's a type that's got a lot of juice in it, mm-hmm. and they crush that, grind it, and then they take the juice and make, boil down the juice into cane sugar.
Okay.
Sweetener.
All right, that was fun. That's the stuff that I'm like, huh, okay. Makes mm-hmm. my little brain
yeah.
percolate.
So this is just something interesting. These small grains, it's called tillering. They put up side shoots. So this is a place where if you actually plant less, you get more.
Okay.
If you actually plant it too thick, they won't tiller. But if you plant less... They put up those side shoots, so one grain, instead of making only one grain head, mm-hmm. makes five.
Okay.
So if you plant them a little bit thinner, you know, you have to play with this. I can't
right.
tell you the rate that you can do it, but anyways, all grains, these small grains do this.
Uh-huh.
And, well, corn does it, but it never, those side suckers.
Right.
But then it's not a long enough season for them to make corn.
Now, I've noticed that.
Yeah. But popcorn sometimes on the very top will have some. But... It's here if you plant these, if you want to take the time to plant grain in a row instead of a solid bed,
mm-hmm.
they tiller more. So even though it's a hassle to plant it in a row and
right.
plant them every 12 inches apart,
uh-huh.
those rows, you're only planting 20 pounds of seed versus 100 pounds of seed.
Okay.
And you get the same production.
Oh, wow. And tillering is a... technique?
No,
or
that's just
grain.
Tillering is just the way a plant, the grains grow on their own.
Okay, we have a caller and we have Anpetu has comments and questions.
Sure. Anpetu.
Anpetu. Thank you for calling Anpetu.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Lance.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
I thought this would get you.
What?
I thought this would get you. Go for it.
Yeah, I offer the largest selection of cereal grains in North America.
Cereal and, grains, great.
Yeah, and also what I call leafy grains, which are buckwheat, amaranth, and quinoa. Someone
mm-hmm.
called them pseudo-cereals because they're not botanically true
okay.
cereals, but the seeds are used like grains. And also the leaves are sometimes used as pot herbs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they have
mm-hmm.
a dual use there besides the seed. But one correction is that einkorn was not domesticated in Eastern Europe.
Where was it domesticated?
It was domesticated in the Middle East.
Oh, okay.
In
okay.
the Levant. And actually, there's recent research pushing back the domestication of cereal grains double what it was to 23,000, 24,000 years now.
Okay.
So people who are really into the paleo diet and stuff like that, there's evidence showing that the use of grains now goes back to over 20,000 years.
Wow.
In the human diet. There's research in northern Israel that they're excavating from sites that have had domesticates showing up in barley and varieties of wheat. So one of the reasons and encourage people to grow their own little wheat or bread patch is I'm a huge bibliophile with books on food and agriculture. I'm doing research all the time. And what has happened with wheat breeding in the United States and other parts of the world for for at least the past 100 years, is that the wheat has been bred to be responsive to yeast as the leavening agent in producing a loaf of wheat, a loaf of bread.
Uh-huh.
And so they bred the varieties of wheat to increase the gluten in order to have it be responsive to the yeast, because what they're looking for is a high-volume loaf. So this has wound up denaturing the relationship between the protein and the carbohydrate in the wheat grain. And I believe that a lot of the allergies that people have sustained with wheat intolerance has to do with the denaturing of wheat, which has gone on for approximately 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it is parallel, the use of wheat in bread baking is parallel to what has happened in monocropping in agriculture as a whole. The other thing is there's what I call folk races, or commonly called land races. Traditionally, in not only wheat, but other grains as well, people grew a diversity of types in one field. So everything didn't ripen necessarily all at the same time and was harvested all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great diversity of germplasm in their seed stock. And what has happened in modern breeding is they emphasize everything being as almost exactly similar as possible, because if you have large machinery going out to harvest hundreds or thousands of acres, it's quite expensive with the cost of fossil fuel, and people don't want to be going out and harvesting, you know, having to go out and do it more than once, really.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're doing it with a sickle or scythe, it's quite a different matter. The other thing is there was research done in Europe many decades ago showing that when you harvest grain with a sickle or scythe, it's different from harvesting it with a combine.
Mm-hmm.
And modern agriculture has paid no attention to this. There's a subtle biochemical reaction that happens. People may recognize from old pictures where they've seen the grain was shocked up in the field with the sheaves leaning against each other when it was harvested by hand. And what happens is that there's a really subtle, another biochemical process that goes on in the grain after it's cut, and after maturation, and after curing that happens in the heads of the grain. And traditionally, what was done, it would be left out there to cure in the sun for a few weeks or so, and then the grain would be bundled up, and it would be aged for 6 months, often, before it would be fresh.
Now, when you say age, is it still on the shocks?
Yeah, it's still on the ear. The ear has not been threshed.
They're just taking it out of the weather.
Yeah, like I said, there's this very subtle, slow, gradual process. It's like, you know, people who are winemakers or any kind of fermented food. If for people who were true, like, cerealists or cerealians, as you might call people who are really into grain culture, you know, or some people have called us grainiacs.
Yeah. You know. Well, I know when
I like that one.
Yeah, I know when I'm growing my grain. I don't try to thresh it until I actually have time later on. So it's usually
on the
stalk. It could be 2 or 3 months before I get to it.
Yeah, and then what also happened is that then the grain would be, after going through this maturation period in the field and then in the ear, then it would be considered fit to be milled into flour. And then when the bread was baked, it would be aged subsequently. And I met this younger Greek guy a number of decades ago, and I was talking to him about this, and he had gone back to visit his ancestral villages in the mountains of Greece. And he told me, he said, yes, he said, it's just the way you say it. He said, the families there, they age their grain like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they bake bread, it's like once a month they'll bake a huge batch of bread, and then they have a room with shelves on it.
Yeah, shelves.
And they'll put all their loaves of bread there and age the bread for 6 months.
Hey, on Petu, we're about ready to.
We're getting close. I would love for you to get a hold of us here at KVNF so that we could have as the word turns grain harvesting and aging. I mean, this is just absolutely brilliant, and there's a lot of people that are doing so many different canning and food saving would be fantastic.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for calling
in. It's an endless subject. It's endless.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks for calling.
Sure, thank you
for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wow, that time flies through. Oh my gosh, I feel like I just got started. Thank you, everyone, for joining Lance and I as the worm turns and talking about grains. I feel like we're just the tip of the iceberg here with the grains.
Yeah, so we're going to have Ron Godin, a soil fertility scientist, come in next week. We're going to talk soil fertility, and he's coming back. He'll be freshly back from a soil conference down in New Mexico, so he'll have lots of neat ideas.
So tune into that.
Yeah, that will be really good.
If you're looking for how to make your soil more fertile and all that jazz, Ron Godin.
Ron Godin from CSU Extension.
Oh, from CSU Extension. Awesome. And again, cannot thank you enough, Lance. And when you come back after Ron, are we going to be talking about compost?
Compost in 2 weeks.
Awesome. So we're going to talk soil fertility with Ron Godin, and then Lance will be back talking about compost. Again, thank you. This is Peggy Soup, and thanks for tuning in to As the Worm Turns.
Yeah, you have a good night.
Have a good night.
I got a gal that I love so, the whole little world knows.